Hello, and welcome to Her Story, the show that explores the history of women told by women. I am your host, Kate Brody, and today we are going to talk about the black female experience in America. We will explore the attempt by the state to retain a property interest in black women's bodies that was once held by their owners during the time of enslavement. Further, we will dive into the racist and sexist past of our country that persists in reproductive oppression today. I'd like to preface this episode by acknowledging that the history lesson will be taught through a reproductive justice approach, meaning it is based on the understanding that the impacts of race, class, gender, and gender identity oppressions are not additive, but integrative, producing a paradigm of intersectionality. There are three core reproductive justice principles that should be assumed while reading this. Every woman has the right to 1. Decide if and when she will have a baby in the condition under which she will give birth. 2. Decide if she will not have a baby and her options for preventing or ending a pregnancy. And 3. Parent the child she has with the necessary social supports in safe environments and health communities and without fear of violence from individuals or the government. Black women have faced a super exploitation, a triple oppression of race, class, and gender that no other marginalized group could come close to experiencing or understanding. It has become a permanent feature in American social and economic life. Let's take a closer look. During the days when slavery plagued America, black women were considered profitable, an investment, something to commodify, and personal property. There is massive historical evidence that illustrates that many slave owners counted on the vicinity of black women as an economic asset and encouraged women to bear children as rapidly as possible. U.S. capitalism and African American slaves were chattel, meaning a privately owned commodity. This gave owners property rights over their slaves. The two primary property rights, use and exclusion. The right of use of one's reproductive capacity and sexuality includes all of the benefits that one could draw from her own sexual decision-making and reproductive labors. With regard to the right of exclusion, this means one right to determine who has sexual access to her body, whether that body will be used for reproduction, and whether that body will be subjected to restrictions based on one's reproductive status. As much as enslaved Africans were the property of their owners, the sexual and reproductive capacities of these women were also owned, further reinforcing their status as property. Let's discuss a few ways that slave owners possess property rights of use and exclusion in black women's sexuality and reproduction. Being denied the benefits of one's own reproductive labor, a human rights violation according to our reproductive justice principles, and a traumatic experience for enslaved mothers and families. The joy that parents receive in seeing their children grow and thrive was often denied to slave women, says Jill Morrison, author of The Resuscitating the Black Body. Breastfeeding was another benefit of reproduction denied to enslaved black women. Masters often forced enslaved women to refrain from breastfeeding in fear that it would disrupt their ability to work. Enslaved women were also used as wet nurses for white children, meaning both the enslaved mother and child were deprived of the benefits of breastfeeding. One article discussing slavery and wet nursing says, as a form of exploitation specific to slave mothers, enforced wet nurses constituted a distinct aspect of enslaved women's commodification. Slaveholders forced enslaved women to wean their own infants early, from around 6 months, so they could return to their labors. Yet, ironically, wet nurses had to feed the white children until they were about 2 years old. Enslaved women also had no right to exclude others from access to their bodies, often resulting in rape, unrecognized as a crime, and with impunity extending to owners' family members, overseers, and sometimes even visitors to the household. The fertile womb of enslaved women, especially after the slave trade was banned, became the biggest producer of wealth for owners. When reproduction was not up to par, owners took means into their own hands, exposing the enslaved women to constant sexual abuse and rape. The system that allows for sexual chattel of enslaved black women can be heard in a condemnation by activist Sojourner Truth in 1851 during her speech historically referred to as Ain't I a Woman.
That man over there says that women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as any man when I could get it. And I could bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children, seen most sold off into slavery. And when I cried out with a mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman?
I'm sure you can agree that Kerry Washington is elegant and graceful in her rendition of Miss Truth's speech, but I hope you can hear the urgency in this generation's black woman's voice, like Kerry Washington. The problem persists. It's been 400 years since the first slave ship landed on our shores, 150 since the emancipation. Black mothers are still shackled by legislation that targets or disproportionately affects black women. Current examples of reproductive oppression attempt to restore the state's property interest in the bodies of black women that was lost due to the end of slavery. The right to use and exclude is still trying to be imposed on black women's bodies in sexual and reproductive capacities. The right to use, as previously stated and reinforced by the Reproductive Justice Core principles, gives women the right to any benefits one can have from their sexual decision-making and reproductive labors. This right is denied by a state policy referred to as family cap or welfare caps. This policy denies an increase in cash benefit assistance to families who have an additional child while receiving temporary aid for needy families, or TANF. What we have here is your classic neoliberal approach. By denying cash aid, states can make marriage more compulsory and reproduction more off-putting, thus alleviating poverty and decreasing welfare dependence. The government is the major driver behind the notion that all the social ills are caused by childbearing among poor and often falsely equated with black women. Policies of this type became popular after President Ronald Reagan enforced a stereotype of black women called the welfare queen, implying that these women milk the system. These assumptions and policies hold black mothers responsible for improving the outcomes in black communities that are truly tied to systemic and structural racism. Kiara Bridgers notes that by excluding the work of mothering for a group of women who are disproportionately black, welfare policy reinforces the historic belief that the mother is not a legitimate identity for the black woman the way it is for the white woman. We see another example of this neoliberal focus towards black women in Medilac and Mother's Milk Cooperative's initiative to purchase breast milk from Detroit's black mothers in 2015. Laura Harrison's article exposing the racist approaches of this campaign says, "The MMC and Medilac euphemistically contend that donating breast milk serves women on two fronts. It increases the duration in which donating mothers breastfeed their own babies, and it reduces the financial pressures on new mothers to return to the workforce. Mothers who donate milk save the lives of preterm babies," Medilac argues, "by providing the raw material that science then transforms into fortified superfood. In essence, the company suggests that donating mothers are making a common sense decision to become entrepreneurs by monetizing a substance that they independently produce, own, and control." The problem arose when Medilac partnered with CGI, the Clinton Global Initiative, through a commitment to action, asserting that they developed a new solution to a social problem. In this case, the problem was low breastfeeding rates in black communities, and the solution was a neoliberal approach called pulling oneself up by your own nursing bra straps. Holding black mothers responsible for improving health outcomes of their communities while ignoring the systemic and structural racism that produces the disparities. Pulling oneself up from your nursing bra straps. What an audacious statement. Our country still fails to recognize its racist history of wet nursing and reproductive exploitation of black women, and continues to exploit women of color for profit. There is a quote I am reminded of when I hear both these cases. Audre Lorde says, "In a society where the good is defined in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, there must always be some group of people who, through systemized oppression, can be made to feel surplus, to occupy the place of the dehumanized inferior." In America, black women occupy that space, and that has always been intentional. This intention to dismantle black women and destroy the structure of black motherhood are reflected in the state's attempt to impose the right to exclusion upon these women. During the 1980s crack cocaine epidemic, prosecutors targeted addicted pregnant women, charging them with child endangerment, drug delivery, homicide, and justifying the effort to protect the fetuses from bad mothers. The irony here is that the state does little to advance maternal, fetal, and newborn health for underserved communities. This further served the notion that black women weren't fit for parenting. Some of the interventions are the most drastic type of state intrusion into a woman's lives. Some cases, reduced sentences were offered in exchange for contraceptive use or sterilization. These are blatant attempts to control black women's bodies and reproductive decisions. For centuries, the human and reproductive rights have been violated, and black women have continued to be oppressed by governmental control of their reproduction, frustrating their own desires to procreate, parent, or abstain from pregnancy and childbearing. Today, black women have the highest rates of maternal and infant mortality. The maternal death rate of black women is nearly 4 times that of a white woman. That number increases to 10 to 17 times worse in some states. This is not coincidental. It happened just as the system designed it to happen. Morrison concludes in her article by saying, in the 21st century, black women are at the center of the culture war. Their childbearing is perceived as the root of all social ills, yet that they are the subject of rescues by those who claim to be pro-life. At the same time, they are denied any meaningful social support for healthy parenting and are criminalized for their reproductive decisions. They are demonized as threats to the black community for deciding to terminate pregnancies, often in consideration of what is best for the children they are already raising. And police or private vigilantes can kill black male children who are deemed threats to the white community and suffer no consequence. The current political and social attempts to minimize and objectify black women through their reproductive capacities embodies 400 years worth of oppression and exploitation. And the only way to reject it is by ensuring reproductive rights and justice for all women.